and welcome to another week of Tactical Tips. I'm Rich.
I'm Pat.
I'm Tom.
And this week, we are talking about Pat taking over the world. Pat, where have you just come back from?
I've just come back from Steam Storm in Slovakia. Steam Storm is a really, really awesome tournament, a two-day event run by Martin the Don Hornacek in his hometown of Bratislava. It's great. If anyone gets a chance to go, I hardly recommend it. Anytime anyone asks me what my favourite events are, Steam Storm is high on the list because it's completely unlike any other event. It's a little bit smaller, but the caliber of players is really, really high. It has a lot of players from Poland, Sweden, and Germany, which are three teams that always do great at WTC. And it's just really, really fun. You know, there's a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of going out in the evenings, sharing drinks, having meals. So I love it. Steam Storm's great.
Lovely. And what's the format?
The format was five rounds this year, two lists, DNC one. So pretty standard Steamroller stuff.
Excellent. Well, as you know in this cast, we don't just like doing battle reports. Much delight as it is to listen to Pat tell stories and regale us with how he destroyed everyone. So we're going to focus this week on some of the lessons Pat has brought back from Steam Storm. So Pat, tell us what you've learned.
Yeah, so I had a lot of really good games. The five I played in the tournament, plus a couple of others over the weekend. And for me, the thing that ties them mostly together is experience. What I learned at Steam Storm is it hammered home for me the importance of experience in a matchup and how getting experience can give you a big edge, and also getting limited experience can sometimes be a bit of a trap because you can think you understand a matchup better than you could do, and then your opponent do things you don't expect and that can really hurt you. What I want to do is I want to go through the games because I think almost all of them demonstrate this in some way.
Excellent. Sounds really exciting. So if you kick us off then, I mean, so it's DNC won five rounds. You go there all excited. Round one, what did you get?
Round one, I was played against my good buddy Mark Hayes from Ireland, previously on Ireland Curl WTC. And he was the one player in the event playing Retribution. Just thought I'd throw that one player remark in there for the Facebook group.
How lucky of you.
I mean,
yeah, so obviously that was really cool to play against Mark. I hadn't played against him for a long time, but he and I used to be in the same meta in Cork in Ireland. So I knew he was a great player. He was playing Bran as his main list, and then he threw in Thyron mainly for fun. As his off list, I should probably mention my list for the event, which was I was playing Grimkim. I had the Dreamer in Dark Menagerie, and I had the Old Witch in Bump in the Night. So I picked the Dreamer, and Mark quite rightly picked Ran. Before the game, Mark told me, I've never played Grimkim before. And this was a pretty bad sign for him, because as I think anyone that plays or has played against Grimkin knows, they're a pretty tricksy faction. They play in a really unusual way, and if you haven't played against them, it's very difficult to play around all of their tricks, especially their Arcana. So what I really saw in this game was an example of a really good player who was suffering from not having any experience in a matchup. And Mark had picked a caster who's really pretty good into Grimkin. Like, Ran is probably the best pick in the faction, or one of the better picks in the faction, against Grimkin.
Why is that?
So he's good because, although Grimkin can stop a lot of shooting and magic, they do it by spending resources, right? Like, they expend their Krabbits, they spend Arcane Vortexes to stop spells, and on Ran's feet turn, he can blow through all of those Arcane Vortexes. You know, a unit of Battle Mages can burn through every Arcane Vortex in the army plus Ruin and still pull a model. And Ran tends to run a couple of units of Battle Mages plus other options for control, like his own spells, like Helios, which was in the list. And so he is one of the few casters that can actually control Dark Menagerie enough to do what he wants. And then his Warjacks can be buffed to hit hard enough with Arcanist that they can do massive damage to heavies. And Helios in particular can quite easily kill a Grimkin heavy without much trouble. So that's why I think he's got good game. It's not a walk in the park for him. The Grimkin player can do things to shut him down as well. But he's definitely got game into Dark Menagerie. Unfortunately for Mark, he didn't know a lot of these tricks because he'd never played the matchup before, right? And this is probably the matchup against Retribution I've played the most because it's the one that I think is probably the hardest. And so my default plays kind of were set up in such a way as to make his control elements and his spells as difficult to use as possible. You know, I had my Gorehounds in positions where if he ran his Art Node forward at all, I would be able to trade a Gorehound for it. I had my heavies in positions where he'd need to do very weird things with his battle mages in order to get good drag angles. And if he didn't place them perfectly, one or two vortexes would be able to stop the models doing the initial drags, and then the other models would be out of position so they couldn't get any more drags off. And essentially, I was able to shut his army down a lot more easily than I probably should have been able to had Mark really understood the matchup and known what he needed to do.
Just on that point, Pat, the battle mages, when you say some of his models would have been out of position, what does that mean? I guess it's difficult being on that audio format.
Yeah, yeah, it's super difficult to explain in audio format. But if you imagine I've got heavies base to base with each other in a kind of a semicircle, right, around the death knell, as you do. If you just advance your unit in the classic war machine cluster, you know, everyone is a little bit spread out. They're taking up a rough blob on the table. If you just advance your unit in that way, then some of the battle mages who are directly across from a heavy might be able to pull it out from the gap between the heavies on either side. But the battle mages on the left and the right can't do that because if they're not standing at exactly the right angle, then the heavy being pulled is going to hit one of his buddies.
Got you. Okay? Yeah.
So the positioning answer there for Ran is he needs to put all of his battle mages basically in a conga line so that they all have exactly the correct angle and I can't shut them down from drags, right? Yeah. But that's not necessarily intuitive the first time you play, because normally for Ran, this works just fine. You have battle mages at different angles. The first one pulls the heavy out of the cluster, and then the others pull it around however you want.
Yep, that one makes sense. And how did you protect the guys on the end of the conga line?
I protected them with terrain on one side, and then with models like Gremlin Swarms and Krabbits on the other.
And I'm guessing you knew where those models needed to be at deployment because you'd already thought about it.
Yeah, exactly. So I knew that I needed to keep my models very tightly packed against Ran's shenanigans. The more tightly packed I am, the harder it is for him to get clean angles for slams and for the drags, and the harder it is to find placement spots for TKs. And most Ran lists don't have a lot of blast damage that really punishes my list, especially because I'm playing Dark Menagerie, and honestly, nothing in that list really cares about blasts, right? Even a boosted chain blast is whatever. So I know that playing against Ran, that if I'm very tightly packed and all my models are blocking each other, it makes it really difficult for Ran to do all his normal tricks. Now, it's not impossible, and with the right play, there's often something that you can exploit as the Ran player, but the harder I can make it, the better.
And when you're thinking, like with this matchup, you've got a strategy against Ran. Is this now something you'll look at against any list with a lot of drags? So the Prime Axiom, the Galleons, those types of things?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's exceptional because it's so many drags. Like most lists, a lot of drags is 2, and this list has like 12. But I'm often thinking something like a drag is something that sets off an alarm bell in my head at deployment, right? If I see they have a model in the army that has a drag, I'm going to be looking at the terrain and I'm going to be thinking about what in my list can counter it. And against most other lists, the answer there is Krabbits. And one of the reasons I always run 2 Krabbits is they give you enough coverage that you can use your standard kind of deployment and you can protect every heavy from something like a drag, like a really high value shot. And I'll always try to position, so if there are multiple drags, maybe I can block some of them and then protect the models that are blocking the drag with the shield guards, for example.
Brilliant. So this idea of you having a playbook in your head that you start going through at deployment, it's like how models are going to need to be in formation. Your Grimkin team is actually like an American football team, like the quarterback. That's it. That's the end of my analogy. I don't know. Oh, no, we've lost Pat. Pat, are you there?
Hello.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Wow.
So I think it is kind of true, though. When I was first learning Grimkin, I would map out, okay, how am I going to move? And it was actually just before the changes to pre-measuring, because, of course, Grimkin were in CID, I think, before Steamroller, which was when pre-measuring got changed.
Oh, yeah.
So I learned Dart Menagerie by literally getting a proxy for every model in my admittedly only 10, 50 model army, right? But putting a proxy down for every model and saying, okay, how can I actually stop run? By doing this formation. Okay, now I've moved into that formation. And by doing that a couple of times, I kind of learned the good plays to make. And I would encourage people, if you have real trouble positioning, you can't proxy during a game, but you can figure out what formations you should be adopting and just have a plan for those going into the game.
Yeah, this is something that you could do away from the table, is actually practice deployment, moving into formations for different scenarios.
Yeah, and it doesn't take long before that becomes second nature, especially just little things like it hammered into me things like, if in doubt, keep your models base to base, you know? Keep them as close together as possible. Make sure there's no landing spot for models in that army that might be coming into you. That kind of stuff.
Sweet. Sounds good. So once you shut down Ran, I guess from there it's just a case of attrition, take models away. I guess the feat was neutered somewhat by your positioning.
Yeah. The challenge for Ran is, against Dart Menagerie, his list works in two parts. He has all of his battle mages and himself, which basically fish out the heavies, and then he has his own heavies to kill the heavies, right? And he needs to use both together. And I was able to mitigate his ability to fish out my models, and then I was able to take out heavies before they could really get a lot of work done. And a particularly useful tool in that matchup is Enfeeble on the Dreamer, which is fantastic whenever you're facing down a Colossal. In this case, it was Helios, and an enfeebled Helios is not that much of a threat. I think there was one particular turn where he had got -2/-2 to attack and damage rolls from Enfeeble, -1 from Ill Omens, and he'd got -2 to hit from a Gremlin Swarm. And so he was rocking an impressive mat of 1. Rat 0. It's pretty bad.
Rat 0. Oh, lovely. Excellent. So were there any other key points from that game, or did that just ride you to victory, enfeebling Colossals, stopping drags, taking heavies out, and then just...
Yeah, basically, I could just do exactly what I wanted, and although Ran had the capability to stop me, Mark just wasn't really aware of exactly what he needed to do, and it didn't become clear to him, especially because I was aware of what needed to happen, and I was focusing on the right targets to make it difficult, so the opportunity didn't present itself naturally. And it just, like I said, it hammered home to me the importance of understanding a matchup and having played it, because it gives you such a big edge.
Yeah, it certainly sounds it. Certainly sounds it. When you were playing it, did your opponent know, could he see what was going on? Because obviously he's done the War Machine blob, like run people, space them a bit, look organised, and then you've come up in the kind of the conga line or the holding hand shuffle with all the beasts. Was there any point where you literally went, that looks strange, why are you doing that?
It wasn't... Like, my positioning wasn't so weird on the table that I don't think it set off any alarms. It certainly didn't seem to, no. I think he just kind of... He realised once the vortexes started happening that my positioning had basically shut him down. But I think one of the challenges, right, is if you've never played a faction before, there's so much to learn.
Oh, wow, yeah.
That you're not really... You don't really think about that going in. You know, you don't think, huh, why has that happened? You just kind of get gotcha'd when you play against something for the first time, unfortunately.
Sounds rough. So, nice, easy start. You take out the best retribution player in the room.
Yep.
And then move on to round two. Before we jump in, Tom, did you have any questions about the Ran matchup?
Not really. It's like comes down to the red just probably not... What would red need to have in order to have a better matchup into Grimkin, you think, Pat?
They need to... I don't think they're awful into Grimkin by any means. But what they need is for their heavies to reliably kill Grimkin heavies one for one. And Arcanists help them with that. Possibly Vyros can get to that point, Vyros 2. But Retribution don't have very many damage buffs on their Warcasters. Certainly not when also paired with Speed. which is usually what you need in order to push heavies to that point where they're reliably killing Grimkin heavies in a single activation.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's probably other things, but that's what springs to mind. And there are some casters in Retribution that can do that, so I think they're worth thinking about. For example, Ilara 2 has a speed buff on her feet, and she has Scything Touch. So with Arcanist, you can get a +4 damage buff on heavies. She's usually ran with a lot of infantry, but I think if you were teching for Grimkin in particular, then she might be someone to look at with heavies.
Interesting. We've got one of our locals who's been playing with Ilara 2. Wonderful. So then we're on to round 2.
So I have a little bit of a fuzzy memory of which game was round 2 and which game was round 3. So I think this was round 2. Apologies if I got it wrong. Round 2, I was playing against Dan Scott-Lintott from Scotland. He is on WTC Team Scotland this year. And I had recently played against Dan in the finals of the Conquest Invitational in Norway back in January. And in that game, he is a Menoth player. He played Harbinger, who is his primary caster, I'd say, his favourite that he's been winning a lot of games with. And I played my Dark Menagerie list that I was using for that event. Was it Dreamer? Might have been Heretic. Anyway, my Dark Menagerie list. Pretty sure it was Dreamer. And this is another good example of experience. We went into that matchup having never played it. I don't have anyone local to me that plays Harbinger. And I don't think he's got anyone really that plays much Grimkin. So in Conquest, we went into the matchup, both dropping our primary list. And what he discovered is the death knell is really, really bad news for Harbinger. Perhaps obviously, but for those that don't know, it's got Entropic Aura, which is a rule where models within 5 inches of it can't be healed. And so Harbinger's game plan is she's doesn't have very many infantry, but they hit really hard and they get kept alive with martyrdom. She heals them every time they die, and the death knell just stops that. On top of that, they also have access to the Affliction Arcana. And this matchup is one of the few matchups where it's actually worth considering using Affliction, because Affliction stops healing for a whole round. And so this basically destroys Harby's game plan. So we both learned that back in Conquest. And so meeting up again, we have basically the same lists. In fact, I think we both had our same pair. I was running Dreamer of Witch. He was running Harbinger Dust. And we both knew the same thing, which is Harby probably can't handle Dreamer. So from my point of view, I'm still going to drop Dreamer, because I think she's good into both lists. But Dan is in a really tough spot where he knows his Harbinger list probably can't cut the mustard, and he doesn't know what Durst can do. He suspects it might not be good enough, but maybe it's got game. So he chooses to drop Durst. So we're now in a new matchup that neither of us have played before, and we get to learn it kind of the hard way, I guess.
Tournament. Brilliant.
So this is kind of an interesting matchup. He's got 4 heavies. I've got 5 heavies. That's bad news for Durst. But what Durst has going for him is he himself is basically a 5th heavy, right? He's like a power 15 weapon master. He's super tough, especially on feet turn, where his feet can let him move damage to his heavies that get an armor buff. So Dan's plan, which I think is pretty good, is he's going to use Durst as a 5th heavy, exploiting the fact that Grimkin have a really low threat ranges to try and even up the piece trade. And he's going to use Durst's feet to try and get ahead in the game. His army can't hit as hard as mine, but with his feet, he can survive better. And he can maybe try and grind it out on an even playing field. He had a cool list, by the way. It was in Faithful Masses. So it was 4 really good heavies, 4 premium heavies, 2 Templars, a Sanctifier and an Indictor. The Sanctifier in particular is great tech against Grimkin. It makes models in 10 inches corporeal, so it stops Gremlin Swarms from doing a lot of their mischief and makes it easy to kill them, which is pretty nice. In Faithful Masses, he was running a unit of Zealots, as well as a bunch of Paladin Solos, 2 of the new guys on horses, and Billman. And the Zealots really are just there to be recursive infantry because of their mini feet that trigger, what's it called? The bonus from Faithful Masses.
So the Righteous Vengeance.
Righteous Vengeance? Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Hand of Vengeance.
+2, +2. I forget because Durst has the other one as well, right? He's got the upkeep that gives one model Righteous Vengeance. And then he also has... Hallowed Avenger, thank you. And then he also, so he's got all kinds of vengeance going on, it's bad. So a couple of interesting things I learned about that matchup. First up, if I don't kill Zealots, then his heavies can't kill my heavies. Because he's relying on that buff from whatever vengeance it is to get the damage swing.
Yes.
And so that means that I can do this awkward kind of positioning where I'm in the scenario zones, and if he wants to come in with heavies, they're in threat range. But if he alphas me before that happens, well, I haven't killed any of his infantry, and so he's not going to hit very hard. So that gave me a bit of control that I didn't expect. Another cool trick that I had up my sleeve was Dreamer can turn models into phantasms, which removes them from play and isn't an attack. So it gets around both of those vengeances. So I could take out key models that were blocking scenario or that were just really valuable, like Vilman, for example, without actually triggering Righteous Vengeance. So I could selectively kill a couple of models a turn without having to worry about Durst Alpha.
Cool.
Yeah, so that was really cool. So I learned that about the matchup, which was great. And then once we started peace trading, Dan sent in Durst to do a lot of damage, but he made one really important positioning mistake. The game didn't last very long because I think he went in on turn two or three, and then I was able to kill him the following turn due to this mistake. But essentially, I'd done big damage to one of his heavies the previous turn through hitting it with the charging Skinner Moans. It had moved away with Enliven and taken a free strike, so it had taken a lot of damage. It was the heavy that Durst had come in, killed my Skinner Moans that had done that, and was sitting next to this heavy. And with his feet, he can move damage to the heavy, and the heavy gets +4 armor. But the problem with that play is that heavy only had about 10 boxes left. So a couple of Gremlin Swarms move up. They both do D3 +3 damage. They get it really low. And then it only takes one boosted damage roll from a Cage Rager to take it out, at which point Durst is really vulnerable. And a pair of Manifest Destiny Cage Ragers were able to pummel him into the ground. Yeah, so one of the things that we both learned about that matchup was having Durst in the front line to peace trade makes sense, but the Dreamer has loads of ways to punish him because he's only tough when he's next to a heavy, and not only can Grimkin kill heavies even when they're armor 23, because they have loads of auto damage from Gremlins and they have a lot of damage buffs on their heavies, but I have so many movement shenanigans that I can kind of get rid of the heavies that are protecting him.
Yeah.
You know, if he's next to lights, I can drag them with Gorehounds. I can bulldoze heavies with the large Phantasm. I can Abyssal Gate heavies if they've used battle the previous turn to do damage on the Alpha. So I have all these, not to mention like power attacks, right? I can slam them or whatever. And I can beat back them with Cage Ragers. I've got all these ways to move his heavies around. So although his plan seemed great on paper, once it actually reached the battlefield, you realize, this isn't probably going to work unless I play it in exactly the right way. Mm-hmm. And obviously, neither of us have played it before. We're not going to play it in the right way. And I was able to find that angle to kill him.
How far into the matchup did you identify that killing Zealots was a trap?
Immediately. As soon as I saw it was Faithful Masses, right? Because the reason you run lots of Jacks in Faithful Masses is you want that damage buff. And I saw it was in Faithful Masses. I looked over Durst's spell list. This is something I'd always recommend, just as an aside. If you're playing in a matchup and you haven't played the caster for a long time, just check their whole card in War Room. You know, read every spell on their list. The number of times I've been reminded about something sneaky a caster can do, because I've done that, it's really invaluable. But I looked through Durst's spell list and I saw he had no damage buff. And I thought, okay, without a damage buff on this caster, the only way he's going to kill my heavies is by going all out with battle and with vengeance. And I can stop that.
Happy days.
So your first round was Retribution and your second round was Protectorate.
Yep.
Protectorate, what do you think, Tom? Really good, Tom. What's up? You're bitching on Amon a few weeks ago. What's your beef with Protectorate?
Wait. I don't think I ever said they were very good, was it? No, I think we put them in like year three. I think they're okay. They also probably, I don't feel like they're very good against Grimkin either, right?
I definitely agree that they're not great against Grimkin. Dan and I were discussing this after the game, and we played a practice game on the Sunday as well to try different answers for Grimkin. And I think right now, They have some lists that are solid, but nothing that really conclusively answers Dark Menagerie. They can play a game with Amon. They can play a game with Exemplars, with a couple of different casters. But I think those games are at best 50-50.
Yeah.
Which is fine. Like, 50-50 is good. It's kind of what you want for every match, right? But they're certainly not one of those factions that can tech really hard for Dark Menagerie and get a really great answer that gives them a big edge.
And do you think Harby is that bad? So I know on paper, the Death Knell is shuts down healing, and there is the Arcana as well that shuts down one round. But actually, like, when I see where the Death Knell is and how Harby plays, it can't be everywhere at once. It's actually really tricky to get the Death Knell and make it relevant and not just give it up.
What I've found is it's not that tricky because... it can be tricky sometimes, but the problem Harby has is she wants her army to basically be a blob in the middle of the board because she wants them all within 10 inches of her for Marta. Yeah. And Dark Menagerie wants its army to be a blob in the middle of the board because it wants to be all within 5 inches of the Death Knell for +2 armor. And so you end up in a situation where if you both armies just play their normal game plan, then they're going to meet in the center of the table. And you're going to have a problem where the Death Knell is just behind all these heavies, but Harby's lists don't really have a lot of high-powered shooting, so you have to get through the heavies before you can get to the Death Knell. But anything that commits into the heavies is then going to get killed because it's in the aura of the Death Knell.
Okay.
And you can create this situation where in a lot of times on scenario, you're kind of forcing Harby's infantry into the heavies. The heavies are surviving, and then they're killing everything that's engaging them. And they're not necessarily killing a huge amount every turn. They might only kill one or two models each, but they can keep this up indefinitely. And it's really hard for a lot of the Harby lists, which are mostly melee. And Menoth melee tends not to be very fast, right, or maneuverable. It's very hard for those models to reach the Death Knell because it's literally surrounded by war beasts.
Yeah.
You have to go through the Warbeast first.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Now, Dan and I were discussing after the game, and I think we agree that probably what he should have done is he should have dropped Harby and tried to play her in a different way where he was breaking the symmetry of that matchup and he wasn't just doing the thing that I just described, which is forcing him into a poor situation. He is running a lot of Rapper Masters, which are good against heavies. If he can create a situation that forces me to spread out or leads some of my heavies vulnerable to being charged by a lot of Rapper Masters all at once, then that's probably how he can win that game. As well as trying to abuse... Well, he always will try to abuse Orr and his defensive tech, but trying to maximize that aspect of his army and trying to pull my army apart so that I can't have the Death Knell everywhere is probably what he has to do in that matchup. Although I definitely think it's tough for him, it might be winnable.
Wonderful. So you're down to round three.
Yeah, so game three was against Tomas from Poland. He's one of the War Room PL guys, another very cool podcast that do a lot of great battle reports. And he was playing Bradagus. His pair was Bradagus Kruger 2, both in Bones of Ouroboros, which is the theme force that runs all the worlds. And his Bradagus list was... Oh my gosh, now I remember that all the worlds have the same names. Okay, he had...
Can you describe them by shape? Because I don't know the name.
He had 6 of the little worlds that have lots of high armor and turn to stone.
Yep.
He had 2 of the new worlds that are made of twigs.
Yep.
And he had 2 of the big worlds that have rams for hands.
So to note, there are 2 of the big ones. There's the fat big ones...
I got it.
And then there's the tall big ones that look like a wannabe megalith.
Yeah.
No, I got it. So his list was 6 World Watchers, 2 World Whites, and 2 World Guardians.
Yes, that's exactly what it was.
I still don't know what's in it.
He also had 2 units of Shifting Stones, a Black Clad Wayfarer, 2 units of Sentry Stones, and 3 of the new guys holding eggs.
What are they? Who are they?
Well,
what do they do?
Black Clad Stone Shapers. They're mechanics. They're mechanics that they also give +2 strength to a world, and they also have fury management.
They're basically arcanists, but for world.
Okay. And the Twig Stone Men, the new light ones, are they the Shield Guardy ones that set things on fire around them?
Yes.
Yeah. So they do 2 important things for that list. They are shield guards and they start the synergy chain.
Right. Good.
excellent. So six little guys, two big ones, two stick ones, three egg holders, and some stones.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect.
Stones and twigs just everywhere.
Just everywhere. Yeah.
So once again, for the third time, I dropped the Dreamer. Because I thought my Bump in the Night list couldn't handle either of his two lists. And I thought my Dreamer list had enough armor cracking for both of the rolled variants that he took. So I took the Dreamer. We made... So he went first, he runs forward, I run forward. And then we both kind of start doing positioning, trying to maximize what we can. I make a play... Well, basically, I think both he and I misplayed our opening turns. I gave him my Gremlin Swarms too easily because I was worried about him feeding on me early to push his army forwards and to alpha me. And I was blocking positioning with my Gremlin Swarms, but that made it too easy for him to kill my Gremlin Swarms early on. On the other hand, in order to kill some of the Gremlin Swarms and to get some shots off on Gorehounds, he moved some of his World Watchers forwards. And let me charge them. So basically, I gave away my Gremlin Swarms too easily. He gave away some of his lights too easily. And that was basically mistakes on both our parts. What this meant, though, was before combat really started and either side had committed its army, I'd lost all my Gremlins, bar one, and I'd taken out three of his lights. I think two Watchers and a Twig guy. And then we started trading. Now, the big problem that Braddock has had is his particular list only has two heavies. And with synergy, those heavies smash my heavies, but the World Watchers just don't do anything. Even with plus three, they only go up to like power 15, and my heavies are armor 21. So they do basically negligible damage. And so he alphas into me, his two heavies kill two of my heavies, but then my three remaining heavies kill both of his heavies and a light, and then he's basically stuck, where his army can't kill my heavies anymore. Now, we are playing on spread the net, and he has a lot of game on scenario, right? His sentry stones are doing incredible work on the flanks, scoring points and stopping things like Krabbits and my surviving Gremlin Swarm and various other phantasms from scoring and contesting. But what I'm able to do is I'm able to kill enough models every turn that I can create phantasms every turn and I can contest all of the relevant pieces of the board and score on any points that I've cleared. And we basically grind it out to turn seven. And at the end of turn seven, both of us have very few models left. I've got three basically untouched heavies and a couple of solos. And he's lost his battle group, but has a load of solos and sentry stones all around. At the end of the game, I win by one CP. And the thing that I learned afterwards, or the thing that I think this shows about experience, is we discussed the game, and one of the things Thomas said is, I thought that matchup was a lot better than for me than it was. And the difference is, I've played this matchup a bunch of times with one of my friends back in Poland, but he doesn't use phantasms like you did in this scenario. And usually I can just win on scenario really easily. But because I was prioritizing creating and placing phantasms to keep me alive in scenario, I was able to play to turn seven and eventually win in that way, even though Dark Menagerie naturally is pretty bad on scenario. Having three Gorehounds and a load of phantasms helped massively. And it kind of rang a bell for me because it reinforced a lesson that I'd learned a long time ago with Signar, which is sometimes when you're preparing for a matchup, you can fall into a trap where you can get experience in the matchup, but you don't realize that the opponent you're playing against isn't doing some important things with their list. And if you play against somebody who knows the list better, then you run into a huge problem because you thought the matchup was really good. And then it turns out, oh, no, actually, it's not, because they just need to do this thing differently. And then it completely flips it on its head.
Interesting. So what was his other list?
His other list, I actually have it written down. I'll put it up for you. It was Kruger 2, which I think is an awesome choice. Do you agree?
For the as a pairing, or
just I guess, well, tell me. I just think Kruger 2 is really, really good and underrated right now.
Yes, I would agree with that. He's he has a lot of problems right now, and I would probably play him as one of my two lists if I in like a competitive setting. Okay, cool.
So okay. His list was Kruger 2 with Megalith, two Wald Wardens, Rich, those are the heavies that look like Megalith, two.
Okay, thank you.
Two Wald Weirds. They're the little guys with eyes that shoot guns and float around.
Oh, the Trims.
Yep. Two black-clad stone shapers, guys with eggs, black-clad wayfarer, Bogtrog Mistspeaker, two units of sentry stones with mannequins, one unit of shifting stones, and a celestial fulcrum.
Okay, so Battlegills was the right drop for him, because I don't think that list can beat like Dark Menagerie. Would you agree?
Yeah, it doesn't have enough armor cracking. When I looked at it, I thought, oh my gosh, if I drop Bump in the Night into this, I'm going to lose every model in my army and kill nothing. But it just doesn't seem to... He's got no damage buff, and the heavies he's chosen don't hit especially hard.
Yeah, it's the more like a range list with a lot of a denial element with Stormwall, TKs, and the Courier's Feet, and Rebuke.
Yep.
In general, I think against Grimkin, I would prefer to have Una 2 as a caster in my pairing. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think Una 2 is the best answer in circle for Grimkin. She's very strong.
Yeah. In that list, Tom,
when you say Una 2 is best, like what makes Una 2 good into Grimkin?
It's very similar to why Abby 2 is good. She obviously has a flank with the Griffins, and then her feet gives them +2 speed and immune to free strikes, so lets them immune to melee attacks, which lets them get really aggressive, and you can take out a lot of their heavies with access to primal and hand defeat, which effectively makes an Abby 2 effect where your army not super massively but still outthreats the Grimkin army by a decent chunk. And you can really dictate because of the threat ranges, you can dictate how the scenario game is going to go.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The Bradley's list, it's a good list, but I do agree with Pat that it does sound like it hits a bit too light in order to crack the five heavies in your Dark Menagerie list. Like if the list had like two more Guardians or like even like Megalith and a Guardian, it would have been a lot better.
Yeah, Megalith in particular is really good against things like Grimkin or Heavies. As Thomas was happily explaining to me after the game, you can use Megalith's Animus to create rough terrain, which can really limit the amount of retaliation you receive, especially because you also have Weight of Stone on Megalith to reduce the speed of the Heavies you hit, and you have Braddock's Feet to pull him back. So he can go in with the other Heavies, beat up the front line, put down rough terrain, and then be pulled backwards, and the Cage Ragers can't get to him in retaliation.
Yes. It's a bit, yeah. He is, awesome he is very, yeah, very good in that regard. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I think other, like, the World Watchers with the synergy and the buff from the Stone Shapers do get to pound 17, which is a decent number, but because they're only two Fury, and when they do go in, they are usually not stone formed, which makes it really easy to kill on the swing back, which is the problem for World Watch.
Yeah, I mean the World Watchers are not great in this matchup. I agree. Even if they are stone formed, I was still killing them with heavies. Like a heavy will just go in with Manifest Destiny and kill an Armor 21 Light because it doesn't have that many boxes, and they're also ignorable. You know, one of the things I can do is if he goes in to try and block me on scenario by using Earth's Blessing, he has to do that after he's moved. And if he ends his move within 3 inches of a Cage Rager, which is often where he wants to be, then I can cancel it with the Vortex. And then I can beat him back and stop him. So I was able to stop the Armor 21 guys from actually contesting a lot of the time.
Well, and if they're not doing that and they're not doing anything output-wise, then they're very sad.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, with more heavies, I can see the matchup being favored in Braddock's favor because he does have with his feet and his energy, he does have a decent alpha and hits real hard. And then I think it's just like this particular build is not great into the Grimkin DM, especially with the Dreamer because she has the access to Manifest Destiny where you can buff up all of your heavies at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. I think Braddock is absolutely fine into Grimkin. And like you said, it's just a case of how these two particular lists matched up. And if my list was different, or if his list was different, then it could be a whole different game.
Yep.
Cool. So that was end of round three. Was this then break for Saturday night?
It was break for Saturday night. So
bedtime?
One of the Yeah, obviously. So yeah, so Saturday night we had a few drinks, we went to a restaurant. In between drinking binges, Johan, one of the Swedes, challenged me to a practice game. We knew the pairings for the next day, and he knew that his semi-finals opponent was playing Grimkin, and he knew that I was also in the semi-finals on the other side, so there was a decent chance he would see me in the finals, and he wanted to try his list into Dark Menagerie. So he and I played a game, Xerxes 2 versus Dreamer, and he smashed me. He smashed me to pieces. Basically, I played my normal defensive brick, kind of a semicircle in the center of the table with a big old house right in the middle of the board, and Turtles and Drakes with Xerxes' feet and Ignite were able to take out three of my five heavies in a single turn. And even with Manifest Destiny, I couldn't reliably kill his Turtles in Retaliation with a single Cage Rager each. So I think one Cage Rager plus a bunch of Gremlin Swarms took out one Turtle, because the Gremlin Swarms can do damage to it.
That's so tilting, yeah. But yeah.
They just like, tear its hoof nails off or something, I don't know, poke its eyes.
They tickle it.
Yep. And it's like an elephant, right? It's scared of mice. Rears up, runs away. But then on the other side, there was no Gremlins to help out. That Turtle lived, and it all went downhill from there. So very, very interesting practice game. And this is relevant because he and I played in the finals, which I'll get to later.
So to get to the finals, you had to play round four first. So what was that? There were four of you. Who went into final four?
So, oh my goodness. So final four, it was Johan. It was myself. My opponent in the final round was Arta from Poland. And Johan's opponent was Thomas from, can I remember where he's from? I cannot. Sorry, Thomas. But he was also playing Grimkin.
So had two Grimkin, Scorn, and...
And Krix. Arta was playing Krix.
I was worried so there for a sec. He caught us a tournament. Where's Krix?
Yeah. So there you go, Tom. In terms of our meta ratings, four top-tier factions in the top four.
Yep. No surprises.
Yeah. Johan in particular was complaining every round that he had to fight against Nemo 3, but every round seemed to beat him, so he can't be too bad.
Yeah. Shh, they might unnerf him.
So, yeah. So, Johan was playing Thomas. Oh, Thomas was from the Czech Republic. That's where he's from.
Ah, and, excellent.
And I was playing Arta. So, Arta's two lists were Denny 1 and Denny 2. He was playing Denny 1 in Ghost Fleet. Classic Ghost Fleet list, which was extremely popular a few months ago, prior to it being nerfed, and it's still really, really good. And Denny 2 got reworked in CID fairly recently, and her lists are quite experimental at this point, but they all revolve around having a few really cool heavies, especially Deathjack is very common. Sometimes you see Nightmare, sometimes you see other heavies, and playing in Black Industries. Now, at this point, I was list locked. Well, I wasn't list locked. But I knew that I was fighting Krix this round, and then if I won, I was either fighting Grimkin or Scorn in the final round. I still had to drop Old Witch, and I thought I had a much better chance dropping Old Witch into Krix than I did into either of the finals opponents if I made it into the finals. So I knew I was going to drop Old Witch. Arta, quite rightly, I think, picked Denny Ghostfleet. Although... Had he seen that I was list-locked, he might have been tempted by Denegra, because I think Denegra 2 is pretty good into Bump in the Night. The problem is she's really awful into Dark Menagerie.
And, why is that?
Basically, it's because all of her important spells target enemy models, and Dark Menagerie can stop them all with Vortexes. Hellmouth doesn't really matter in the matchup especially much. I mean, it's fine. It's never a bad spell, but it's not great. And her main defensive tech is incorporeal, but all the Cage Ragers in Dark Menagerie have magic attacks, and then they hand out Wraithbane to the Skinnamones. So basically, her feat has no defensive ability against Grimkin. She's running fewer heavies that don't trade well with Grimkin heavies, and her spell list isn't especially valuable in the matchup because it's too easily stopped.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, based on that situation, I think because I don't think anyone is. I would rate her okay against the Dreamer. Because your things can actually charge on like playing against the Heretic, where you have to deal with Wildfire or Rebuke. So I can see either way, yeah.
Absolutely. So I think it makes sense from Arta's point of view. He's got Denny One, who is probably okay into both, and then he's got a List Chicken situation in Denny Two, where he's probably pretty good into Old Witch, although maybe still not guaranteed by any means. Like, I've got a lot of Wraithbane in that list as well. But Denny Two is awful into Dark Menagerie. So I think if I was an artist situation, I'd do exactly the same thing, which is I'd take the safer matchup.
Yeah.
And so we ended up playing Denny One Ghost Fleet into Ulrich Bump of the Night. Arta doesn't usually play Crix, and he was pretty inexperienced with his list. He was happy to tell me at the start that he hadn't played it very much and he was just having fun trying something a bit different. Although I really like Ulrich, she is definitely the caster that I'm less experienced with of the two. And in particular, I've never played her into Ghost Fleet because I usually pair her with Heretic, and Heretic is just absurdly good into Ghost Fleet. That matchup is like 90% or something if you play it right. So I'd never had a reason to try this matchup before. So this is another example where experience was a huge factor. Neither myself or Arta were really clued up on how this matchup would go. And that's important because this matchup is one of those really knife edge difficult matchups where both of us have loads of things that can screw over the other person, and either of us can kill the opposing player's caster just as soon as they walk into threat range. So Denny is protected by stealth and high defense. Ulrich has Hollowmen and the Frightmare and the Frightmare's Animus on herself, so every ranged attack in her army ignores stealth. And she's got Blind and Scourge to reduce Denny's defense, so she can easily kill Denny if Denny is in threat range of her guns. And Old Rich is relying on armor to protect herself, but of course Denny has her feet in Parasite to reduce Old Rich down to Def 10, Armor 14. And then a few Power 10 guns or a couple of errant charges from Pirates will just kill her. So we were both really cognizant of the assassination. We both have powerful tools against the other person's army. Like, in a one, if I go in too heavily into the Pirates, my army will kill a lot of models, but they will all come back. And the recursion in the Ghost Fleet list is much stronger than the recursion in the Bump in the Night list, especially.
Well, no recursion from your side.
Yeah, all I have is Hellhole from Old Witch, right? Where I can bring back D3 models. That's it. So I can't just play a game where we both fight slug it out because I will lose. However, I have Windstorm, which shuts down all of the guns for the Pirates except the rifles, right? It gives them all -5 range and they've all got pistols. So none of the Pirate infantry are really doing anything. And that really helps me because it means I can stay at range, I can whittle him down, and I'm not forced to have to go in heavy with a lot of stuff, because if I was, it would be a really bad matchup. Now, there's all kinds of other things that are really important in that matchup. For example, he had 4 Arc Nodes, which is a beautiful number to have and makes my life really hard because it means I can't concentrate on taking them out early and having my cast to be safe as a result. He can always keep some in the backfield while sending others forward to do work. He can also use Venoms to just slaughter my troops, and Windstorm doesn't protect against Venom at all. So there's all kinds of really strong plays that both casters can make against each other. One of the strong plays that I made on turn 2 was I shot Old Witch's Crow Cannon, her Crow Storm, at a Wraith Engine, which blinds it, right? Just taking it out of the game. But I made a big mistake in my inexperience, which is I spent more fury than I needed to set this up. I also wanted to use Scourge on the Cane Wraith to knock him down, because he's a very powerful piece, obviously, in the matchup. He does a lot of damage and he threatens my caster. But in doing so, I went down to a single camp, which was not nearly enough. Denegra was able to advance forward, feet on Aldrich. One of her art nodes was able to run to position, and she parasited Aldrich as well. And then even through Windstorm, Arta was able to get about 6 or so power 10 shots on me, which actually against a Def 10 armor 14 model is quite a lot of damage. As it stood, I managed to survive on a single box. Having used my transfer. And then I was able to kill Denny because, as I explained, as soon as she advances forward into range of guns, she dies. And it just took Old Witch and a Frightmare to kill her. That was a super interesting matchup. I would love to play it again. It's one of those matchups in War Machine that's really deep and really interesting. And both players can do really powerful, scary things to each other. which forces you to play a bit more honest. But had I known the matchup better, I probably now would set a rule in my head where, okay, until Denegra feats, I can't go below about four camp. And I can't let more than three or four rifles get within the 15-inch threat range of me that they need to advance and shoot through Windstorm.
It's so interesting hearing you talk about these games and your experience and then the like the little rules and plays you build after them. So I think there's this perception where you've got some players who are just naturally good at the game. And yes, there's natural skill and things like that. But actually, just getting experience and just understanding the key things of matchups is every game we've talked about. It's swung the matchup so much. Like just having those key bits of knowledge just takes it from, well, we'll have some fun to you're going to get absolutely...
Yeah, I agree. I think that's why I wanted... That's why my takeaway, I think, was experience, because it just hammered that home time and time again. You learn things in those matchups and it completely changes how you play. And there's so many games of War Machine that I think are decided that way, but it's not always obvious to the players involved that that's the case, right? And one thing that I'd recommend, or I think it's really important to keep in mind, is if you're not open to those lessons, then you might not pick them up. And if you lose a game and you're too quick to blame something like, oh, my opponent's models are OP, or oh, there was nothing I could have done, then you might miss those important learning points that could help you in the next game.
Yeah, I think we talked about that before, the idea of people saying it's a terrible matchup. And actually, it's like, no, you just need to think about it and play it. Or at least think about it and say why it is, as opposed to, I've lost the game and he had some things that counter some of my things. So that...
Mm.
Also, listen to Tactical Tips. It's good for getting better at working.
Excellent. So you've beaten Denny One off into the finals against your arch nemesis.
Yeah. Battling Johan. So, as I mentioned before, Johan and I had played a practice game in the previous evening. Going into the final round, we ended up on the same scenario as we played for our practice game, which was Outlast, two circular zones, two flags in the middle, on a very similar terrain layout, which is to say a huge building in the middle of the table and very little else that matters. And so I was like, huh. And for a good 5 minutes, I was thinking about what list to drop. Johan was like, so we're doing the matchup again, are we? And I was like, I don't know, I might drop Old Witch. And he was like, okay, whatever, I'm dropping Xerxes. And then I thought, can I drop Old Witch? The problem, of course, with Old Witch is, one, it's the cast I'm less familiar with of the pair. Two, I'm running a lot of infantry and with bad defensive stats, and my protection for them is Windstorm. But his army has six Drakes that all have sprays, and they have increased accuracy on Xerxes' feat turn. Mm. And with mobility, they threat 16 inches. The only models of my army that come close to that threat range are Hollowmen at 17, but Hollowmen aren't going to take out Warbeasts, especially when they have Krayers behind them giving out paralytic auras, right? And they're certainly not going to take out Turtle. So I knew I had some options in that game. I knew that I could use Old Witch to blind a Turtle every turn because he didn't have any Soul Wards in his list. But I just thought, look, I can't see that being good for me. And of course, since I'd lost to Johan the previous evening, I'd also been thinking about what I could have done differently. And I thought, okay, there's some things I can do here that might help me in the matchup. So we play the game. Johan wins the role and chooses to go second, which he never normally does. But it worked great for him the day before, so he does it again. Don't blame him. I set up in basically exactly the same way. What happened in the previous game was I moved my army to both sides of the central building, towing in the two circular zones, surrounding my own flag, threatening his flag. What he did, he feated, the Turtles went in, one on each flank, the Drakes went in with sprays, and the Archidon went in, and with the help of the sprays, both Turtles and the Archidon each took out a heavy. So I lost three heavies. I couldn't retaliate, as I explained, and it was a disaster. In this new game, I advance on turn one, going first in exactly the same way, positioning my army so it's half and half on each side of the building. Johan sees the game playing out in the same way, and he does the same thing. He advances his army, Drake's in the center, one Turtle on each flank, because they can't really be in the center. There's a big building there, and it's going to limit what they can do. So he just has one on each flank so they can go in. They can charge into the center with their really long charge ranges. I'm then able to enact my plan, which is basically I run my entire army into the right-hand zone. Rather than advancing cautiously, using the building to anchor me in the center like I did in the previous game. I just run, so my whole army is on the right, and now the building is between my army and half of his army. Mm. And in particular, one of his turtles is out of charge range of every model in my army. Additionally, all three of my gorehounds have run to engage the drakes on that right-hand side where my army is. So all of the drakes are engaged by multiple gorehounds over a wall. And they're stuck in a situation where if they try and walk away, they're going to get free-strike by gorehounds who have drag, who are going to pull them back in. And if they try to advance over the wall to engage the gorehounds in melee and fight them, they're actually going to leave the threat range of the gorehounds and they're going to get free-struck again. So they're basically trapped. Yeah. I'm able to set up this play, and it's this change in my tactics that basically won me the game, right? I create this play that's very different to what we'd done in the first game because I'd learned my lesson and I knew that my standard play wasn't going to work. Johan is then caught in a really difficult situation where he can play out of this, but his feat is going to be way less effective than it would normally be because his drakes can't get optimal activations to spray because they're all engaged, and one of his turtles isn't going to make any melee attacks on his feat turn, which is a huge amount of lost damage.
Yeah.
I've also created a massive puzzle for him in terms of order of activation. He really needs Xerxes to go in and kill a heavy, in order to get enough work done to swing things at least a little more in his favor. But Xerxes is blocked by a load of drakes. He doesn't want to activate drakes before he activates Xerxes. If he activates those models, who's going to kill the gorehounds? So on and so forth. So by the end of his feat turn, he's only able to kill one of my heavies, whereas in the previous game, he killed three. And unraveling the knot that I've tied with the gorehounds, my heavy positioning, the gremlin swarms, my arcana, all of that stuff he's got to think about. His turn two feat turn has taken about 35 minutes. And that's basically how the game was won. Mm-hmm. Was, okay, we can play from this point, right? I've lost a heavy. I go in, I kill a turtle. We're actually pretty even on attrition, but it's his turn three now, and he's got about 15 minutes left in his clock, and I've got like 35. And we're going to play one of these long drawn out games where we're trading piecemeal. And my army is in the center of the board, protected by just slightly to the right, protected by this building. And I'm threatening both of the central flags every turn. And so I'm threatening to get ahead on scenario. He has to make big plays in order to get ahead himself, but he just doesn't have the time to do it. And in the end, he decides, okay, I've got to go in with Xerxes. I have to get lucky and kill this heavy. I don't have time to mess around. He goes in with Xerxes. Xerxes gets unlucky, fails to kill a heavy, and he concedes, as it's now stuck in melee with the skin of moments.
Awesome. Is there any way, if he hadn't burnt that much time off on feat turn, mm-hmm. you must have had a game plan for I guess, how to win from your big shift right. So how did you think it was going to play out if clock had been irrelevant?
So if clock had been irrelevant, how I thought it was going to play out is I shifted right, I don't lose too much stuff. I'm then able to take apart the Animantrax on the right, kill a bunch of the lights, and bully Xerxes away. It didn't quite work out that perfectly for me because turtles are so tough that I had to commit two heavies and a bunch of gremlin swarms to kill it, even with Manifest Destiny. So I only had... and then I had to send one Cage Rager to contest the left-hand zone. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe I should have done something differently. I don't know. But basically, that meant I only had one heavy that went into the Drakes. He kills a couple of lights. Then Xerxes kills him, repositions away. And basically, the thing that keeps Johan in that game is reposition, right? My army is really, really slow. He's got two battle engines and his caster who has sprint. And Xerxes with sprint can reliably keep ignite on himself, charge in, do massive damage, and then sprint away. And had he had more time, he would have been able to set up a situation where he'd weakened my heavies before Xerxes went in, guaranteed to get the sprint, and could have kept me at arm's length. And my plan to win that game is to start getting ahead on scenario by basically controlling the center of the board. And okay, you can sprint away from me, but if you do, you're not contesting these flags.
Yeah, okay, cool. Sounds really good. So you win Steamstorm?
Yep. Great fun event. We had some very cool and amusing trophies, including an enormous silver fish which I won for being the biggest fish in the shark tank, which I thought was pretty funny. And of course, as a tradition in Slovakia, first, second and third place also come with some lovely bottles of Tetra tea, the local liqueur. So I have that to look forward to as well. But yeah, I love Steam Storm. Fantastic event. I could not recommend it highly enough. If you are interested, please, please badger Martin to run it again. He was thinking that this might be the last year, but I think he's had a lot of persuasion to the contrary. So if it sounds like a fun event you'd like to go to, let him know, because that might make all the difference.
Yay. Cool. And were there any other, we talked about learning from matchups, were there any other key takeaways from the weekend or just observations on the meta or anything you want to bring home from your travels?
So observations from the meta, I think it reinforced quite a lot of what we'd already discussed fairly recently on the podcast. And I guess that's not too surprising, right? Because it hasn't been that much time since we discussed it. But certainly there was a lot of Signar, a lot of Crixes. There was only myself and Tomas who played Grimkin, but we both end up in the top four. So Grimkin weren't in abundance, but did very well. Same with Scorn, weren't in abundance, but did very well. There were a lot of other factions that were doing just fine, and I think there's quite a lot of strong lists. But I definitely think the meta is where we've already placed it right now, and it did reaffirm that for me.
Cool.
Seems like the nerf in to Nemo probably will shake up things a bit.
Yeah, definitely. The Swedes were euphoric, I would say. They came in and like, Have you heard the news about Nemo? I think this was on the Friday night or something. Yeah. So we were hanging out in the venue playing some card games, I think, at the time. And they came in and were celebrating, I think, about the Nemo nerf. So, yeah, I think that could make a difference. Although all the players or all the lists that made it far, a lot of them had to battle through Nemo. And I think a lot of people had plans for Nemo and Haley 3. Although I have to say, I think a lot of the Haley 3 games were lost on clock.
Interesting.
It does feel even with Nemo 3 dropping off, it just means you're going to see Haley 3. It's interesting seeing what people are looking to, because there's some people who aren't looking at Haley 2 at the minute. Nemo 3 has dropped off a bit. So I've seen things like Siege 2. Jake in UK has been playing around with him. I think Cray, this might be his moment now that there isn't Nemo 3 there. Who do you think is going to take the top spot and sit alongside Haley 3?
So I think there's a lot of options there, because Haley 3 is so good as an all-comers list, and she has so few bad matchups that you don't need a particular pair to shore up her weaknesses, right? I think you have a lot of freedom, and it reminds me a little bit of my thinking when I was playing Haley 2 in Mark 2, which was, I just need a list that can win one round of a DNC 1 event, right? I'm going to play Haley 2 every other round. Yeah. I just need a list that doesn't let me down once, right? It just needs to have enough good matchups into the field that I can play it once. And with that criteria in mind, Signar has a huge number of choices. If I was going to go back to them tomorrow, I would be really considering Haley 2, especially if Kane 0 comes out at about the same time as the Nemo 3 nerf and he still has Snipe. I think Haley 2 lists with Snipe are absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, interesting. TA, Snipe, perfect. Yeah, you can dig really deep. Yeah.
You can do bonkers things. You can put Ace on Kane and shoot 3 or 4 inches into their deployment zone plus trick shot.
Sounds like fun times.
Mm-hmm. Having access to Ace with shot types in Haley 2 is really cool. Because you have really reliable shadow fire to enable your assassinations even better. You have reliable thunderbolts. You can temporal accelerate Ace to make him shoot twice. I even saw someone mention on the CRD forums today that you can do a cute trick where your first shot with Ace pushes the model back towards the solo you want to kill, and then your second shot is a trick shot.
Oh my god, that would suit you so much. The stuff you spend ages with, your 4-inch widget going around, oh no, it's all fine. No, you can't get me. What's. Oh, fuck off. Just.
Right? Can you imagine? And I mean, Hurricane, I love Hurricane with Haley too.
Yeah.
And because the 3 shots with slams with her are just terrifying. And I love Hurricane with Striker because that thing with Snipe is incredibly unfair. And the idea of having 3 shots on Haley's Hurricane with Snipe
Yep.
And the extra threat range from temporal acceleration, that's just absurd. So if Kane stays that way, then I personally would be playing Hayley 2, but I think there's a lot of really good options in Signar. And I actually think that as long as Hayley 3 is as strong as she is, that faction is never going to hurt for a competitive pair, because you can play anything you like with her and be fine.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Cool. Well, thanks for that, and congratulations, Pat. Well done.
Thanks very much.
Excellent. And then I think next time we're going to get together. Should we do a little sneak peek? Tom's got something cooked up for us next time, haven't you, Tom?
I am going to a tournament in the San Diego called Kingdom Con, where I'll be running, playing some Crypt.
So Scar 3, yeah?
Yeah. No Scar 3, but these are some lists made by a famous Friedman, Philip, who has made some very questionable lists before. So we'll see how this goes. It'll be interesting.
Excellent.
Cool. Good luck.
Cool.
Yep.
Good luck indeed. Well, until next time, thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Goodbye.